The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Pickering presiding.
Welcome, everyone, to a virtual argument. This is the time and place set for the oral argument in Harvey versus State, case number 72829. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Justice.
We're going to be conducting this basically as normally as possible. The only real consideration is that there's a delay between the sound reaching your ears and leaving the speaker's mouth. So we need to be very courteous with our questions and interruptions. And if we interrupt you, we don't intend to, and we'll assume the same is true from counsel's side. There just is a delay that's unavoidable with our system. So I'd like to call on Ms. Dickinson to proceed as counsel for the appellant. The clock is shown on the screen, and it will function as it normally does. Please let us know how much time you want to reserve for rebuttal.
5 minutes, please.
Very well.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Alfred Harvey. This is a shoplifting case. Alfred Harvey was convicted of robbery. Under the first issue that we presented, the court uses a standard of review from In re Winship and Jackson versus Virginia to decide whether or not the state has proven each and every element of the crime of robbery and every fact necessary for conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. NRS 200.380 subsection 1 defines robbery in pertinent part as the unlawful taking of personal property from the person of another or in the person's presence against his or her will by means of force or violence or fear of injury. Now, the element we are focusing on is the taking of the personal property. As pled in the information and in the jury instructions, Alfred was convicted of taking miscellaneous clothing items from or in the presence of Juan Munez. Now, he's a security officer at TJ Maxx. However, there's no evidence that Alfred took miscellaneous clothing items. The evidence presented at trial was that Alfred concealed 3 men's wallets inside his coat pocket and a jar of women's face cream in his left pocket. We all agree to these facts. In fact, hours before the trial was to begin, the state understood it had no proof that Alfred had taken miscellaneous clothing items from TJ Maxx and attempted to amend the information. State's proposed amendment deleted the word clothing, so it would say that Alfred had taken miscellaneous items instead of miscellaneous clothing items. But Alfred objected, said it's a change in theory. We have prepared our defense based on the wording of the indictment the way it is what he argued. And this amendment.
Ms. Dickinson?
Yes.
Ms. Dickinson, hi, it's Justice Stiglitz. Why didn't the defense run a writ on that? If that was, you know, such a glaring omission or a change or didn't conform to the evidence, why wasn't a writ run prior?
A pretrial writ? My understanding is the trial attorney did not do a pretrial writ because it was going to be part of her defense that miscellaneous clothing items were not taken. So she did not do the pretrial writ. She waited to go to trial.
Okay. The items that were taken, that was not a surprise to the defense. Is that correct?
That's correct. They knew what was taken, but those items were not listed in the information.
Is it your position that the listing of the items constitutes an element of the offense, or is it just a means of committing the offense? What's your position?
Well, it's both. It's an element of the offense because they have to do a take. They have to show that personal property was taken, and I suppose it's also commission because that's what was taken in the robbery. When the court was presented with Alfred's objection, the court spoke to the defense counsel outside the presence of the prosecutor and then came back and brought the prosecutor in the courtroom and said, I have to concede they have kind of a point. The defense has prepared based on notice pleading and the defendant committed the act of robbery by stealing clothing. And the state screwed this up and mistakenly alleged something the facts don't support. So the district court said that he would only amend the information if they were willing to go along with continuance. In making this decision, the court realized that it would substantially prejudice Alfred to go to trial with a change in the wording of the information. But the state decided, no, we want to go ahead. We want to go ahead with the way it was. So they refused to go with the continuance. By refusing to amend the information without granting a continuance, the court allowed the state to proceed. And what they ended up arguing was, well, these items, this wallet and this ring, were actually from a clothing store. During trial and during appellate process, the state argued that the jury could make an inference that these items that were not clothing were in fact clothing. However, Jackson versus Virginia discusses the reasonable inference standard when a jury makes a decision based on conflicts in testimony, and there was no conflicts here. During the appellate stage, the state also argued that the difference between what was pled in the information and the evidence presented at trial was immaterial. It was an immaterial variance. A variance in the evidence and the pleadings, however, is material if defendant is not definitively informed of the charges, and two, double jeopardy is not protected. In Zesdick versus State, this court found a material variance when the defendant was charged as making three fraudulent purchases in three different stores, but one of the receipts is from a different store and a different date. So the court reversed that conviction. That's the same thing that happened here, in that although it's the same date, we have different items. In Hayes versus State, an Alabama case, the court found a material variance when the robbery victim identified the stolen property, but the property was not listed in the indictment. So based on those and on other cases that we cited, we ask that the court reverse his conviction for robbery. Under the second issue, unless somebody has a question about the first, I'll go on to the second. In the second issue, during the appellate process, the defense found a jury note in the district court file that had never been discussed with the attorneys. The jury had asked, can we have elaboration on the definition of by means of force or violence or fear of injury? The jury question showed confusion regarding an element of robbery, and that was the element of force. The trial court did not advise the trial attorneys about the note and instead responded saying the court is not at liberty to supplement the evidence. When we found this note, we immediately filed a motion for a new trial, requested an evidentiary hearing, motion to reconstruct the record, and requested to have the motions decided by the trial judge. The trial judge, Judge Bixler, he was available. However, the non-trial judge whose courtroom we were filing the motions in, Judge Smith, spoke to Judge Bixler and then decided Judge Smith would make the decisions on all the motions.
Ms. Dickinson?
Yes.
It's Justice Kadish. I know it's kind of hard to find people on the screen for you. When it was requested of Judge Smith to allow Judge Bixler to decide those motions, was NRS 175.101 cited or brought to that court's attention so they could actually consider whether that statute required the trial judge to consider the motions?
I thought we had pled it. I'd have to double check that. It was my understanding that we did plead that. Because NRS 175.101 does require the trial judge to do that. I know we filed several motions with Judge Smith, all of which were denied, including the request for an evidentiary hearing.
So when it was requested for Judge Bixler to preside over the motions, was it, do you know if it was brought to Judge Smith's attention that in fact there was a mandatory requirement
for Judge Bixler to preside over post-trial motions, even if the statute may not have been specifically cited?
Your Honor, I thought we had cited the statute, but I'd have to double-check the transcript. I know that we did ask that he handle it because he would not understand the facts of the motion for a new trial. Judge Smith did not know anything about the notes from the jury or why they were important. There was no evidence that Judge Smith had ever read the transcripts. So we had asked that he handle it. He said he spoke to Judge Smith, and Judge Smith didn't remember anything, and that was the end of
Wait,
it.
Wait, I'm sorry. Can you say that one more time? He said he talked to...
Judge Smith told us he had talked to Judge Bixler on his own, and Judge Bixler did not remember, and so there was no reason for Judge Bixler to make any decisions on the motion.
Okay. Ms. Dickinson,
How long after the trial? Sorry.
Justice Kagan, why don't you go ahead with your question?
Sorry, we're all dealing with the technology. My question was just how long after the trial was it that this motion proceeding was happening and the question was being raised?
It was approximately 1 year.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Judge, excuse me.
Okay, Chief, can I go ahead?
Yes.
Ms. Dickinson, Mark Gibbons here in Las Vegas. My question is, assuming we agreed with you this was error by Judge Bixler not notifying the attorneys here, can you tell me why it's not harmless?
Your Honor, it's not harmless for several reasons. One, because there's no record that Judge Smith had ever read the record so that he could make an accurate decision. And under the statute, NRS 175.101, it infers that if a non-trial judge is making a decision, he needs to be satisfied that he or she can perform these duties. And Judge Smith never made that finding, so we have no finding of that. We have no finding in the record that he read anything. It's not harmless because we never had the evidentiary hearing. We needed an evidentiary hearing to find out what happened behind closed doors in the courtroom hallways and what the marshal said to the jury to actually decide all the prejudice involved. But under the Gonzalez case and the Jeffrey case, we know that there was error that occurred because the jury should have been informed of the note and had the opportunity to craft our own response to the jury. And if I could save my remaining time.
Yes, of course. Mr. Rose.
Good afternoon, Madam Chief Justice, members of the Supreme Court, and may it please the Court. My name is Stephen Rose, and I represent the respondent, State of Nevada. There are the three issues presented in the petition, and unless the Court has any preliminary questions or areas that you would like me to focus on, I will address each one in turn. Hearing no questions to start. Starting with the first issue, the variance issue, the State would first note that this issue should be deemed waived. In the appellant's opening brief prior to decision by the Court of Appeals, the appellant, or my colleague, raised the question of the sufficiency of the evidence that when it came to whether or not the state had proven miscellaneous clothing items, the entirety of the argument was two sentences long. There was no citation to any legal authority, nor was the term variance brought up in any way, shape, or form. Similarly, in the state's response to that portion of the argument, there was no reference to variance and no argument brought up. It was not until the reply brief was filed that it went from being a two-sentence argument to nearly a four-page argument. So, although the Court of Appeals decided the issue under NRS 28C, it should not have been raised, and I would ask the Court to deem it has been waived. However, if the Court chooses to consider the issue, I would first argue that there simply was no variance. Unlike Jesdick, unlike Citron, unlike some of the other cases cited by my colleague, this was not specific factual allegations with respect to the items that were taken. a reasonable jury could infer or could conclude that these qualify as miscellaneous clothing items. However, even if the court did decide that it was a variance, the Berger case lays out what the question is. It's not whether there was a variance, but rather, if there was a variance, was it such that it affected the defendant's substantial rights? Which then entails two questions. Is it something that prevented him from being able to mount a defense? And two, is it something that would prevent him from being subject to double jeopardy? Looking at the second portion of that first, does it, you know, subject him to double jeopardy? My colleague argues briefly that because he wasn't charged with stealing these particular items, he's simply not subject to double jeopardy. I think that that raises a couple of issues. First, trial counsel recognized that these were the exact items that were listed in the arrest report, that were listed in the property report, that were discussed at the preliminary hearing, and were discussed at trial. In fact, they said that they planned their defense entirely around that particular issue. If we accept my colleague's argument, that defense simply makes the entirety of the trial a waste of time, because even if they were to succeed at trial and get an acquittal, if double jeopardy doesn't attach, the state would simply be free to charge him again. So it kind of makes that defense nothing more than a waste of time. Further, it raises the second question of, well, he was charged with robbery with use of a deadly weapon. If double jeopardy does it not attach also to the use of the deadly weapon portion, or are we going to say that it attaches piecemeal to different parts of a claim? Looking at the first question, whether or not it's sufficient to allow the defense notice in order to prepare a defense, defense counsel in this case noted prior to trial specifically that they were aware of the exact items that were alleged to have been taken, and those are the exact items that evidence came out at trial. Those were the exact items that they said they prepared a defense around that particular argument. So based upon this court's decision, particularly in State v. Jones, where the sale of a controlled substance was alleged to have occurred to one individual, where the transcript showed it happened to another individual, this court concluded that there was not a material variance there. And I think rather than having to clarify it, as my colleague suggests, this court would have to overturn State versus Jones. Before moving on to the second issue, do the justices have any questions about the variance issue? Then I'll go briefly on to the second issue, because the second issue is whether it should have been Judge Bixler to hear these motions. Justice Keyes, I believe you asked how long afterwards these motions have been filed. I believe it was, in fact, 17 months afterwards. The trial itself took place in November of 2016. These motions were filed in April of 2018. By my count, that comes out to about 17 months. Additionally, Justice Keyes, you asked whether or not NRS 175.101 was ever cited in those motions. And in looking through the record on appeal, it's not cited in those motions. Those motions can be found at the beginning of Volume 6. Specifically with respect to my colleague's argument that there's no indication that was aware of the case, was aware of the note, read the transcripts, I would note out that the transcripts were in fact attached as exhibits to the motions for new trial and for reconstruction of the record, as was the copy of the jury note. Moreover,
Mr. Rose, let me just cut in. Sorry, it's Justice Stiglitz. Do you agree, 175.101, Judge Bixler, if he's available, should have been the judge to hear the motions? I mean, is that a controversial statement in some way?
I don't believe that it presents a requirement, Justice Stiglitz, for a couple of reasons. My colleague's argument is that because of the wording of it, that only physical disabilities are sufficient to allow a different judge than the trial judge to hear the motion. And I think that that presents a problem. This motion was, as I mentioned, filed 17 months afterwards. There's a lot of things that can happen in those 17 months. If we accept my colleague's argument, a justice who is not reelected or who is reelected or appointed to a higher bench would not be physically disabled from hearing the motion, but are we going to rule that they have to come back and hear it? or...
But that's a little different circumstance. You agree, if the you're mentioning the passage of time, but part of the passage of time was because nobody knew that he had not given them a jury note or not notified them. So just as a non-controversial premise, if the trial judge is available, don't you agree that that is the person that should be hearing the post-trial motions?
In many circumstances, yes. In this particular circumstance, I'm not entirely sure, because one of the things that my colleague says that they would want to know is why the court did not notify the parties. It seems to me that there might be questions that the parties would have for Judge Bixler about why he didn't notify the parties, if he was the person who, in fact, typed out the response. And it seems like it would be difficult to have the judge both being asked questions by the parties and then making rulings on his own, the propriety of his own actions, particularly in circumstances here where he indicated that he has no memory of taking those actions. I would also point out to the court that this particular statute falls within Chapter 175, which governs trials. That chapter ends with the verdict or with the requirement of a penalty hearing on a first-degree murder. Chapter 176 is the chapter that governs a motion for a new trial. All of that happens after the verdict, even up to 2 years after the verdict. And the statutes contain different wording. 175.101, cited by my colleague, specifies the judge. The motion for a new trial statute found in Chapter 176 doesn't say the judge, it says the court. And I think there is an important distinction there, in part because of the potential lapse of up to 2 years in time for a motion like this.
But this is Justice Pickering here. I have a question for you. Certainly in civil cases, if a judge is asked to reconsider what a prior judge did or didn't do, that new judge gives deference to the prior judge's ruling, whether that would have been a ruling he or she would have made originally on that question. And I read this statute with some care, because it does seem to say if the judge is available, that judge should sit on that. So it's not just a question of what does the judge remember or not remember, but also I think to some extent the legal standard of evaluating the propriety and reasons for what the original judge did. And I think the statute expresses a preference that the same judge should do it, because you might get a more straightforward assessment without any deference due to a prior colleague's ruling. Can you comment on that?
I will try, Justice. I'm not as familiar with civil practice, but I think the statute may exhibit a preference, but if we look at the context of that particular statute, it seems to appear that once the verdict has come in, but prior to Chapter 176 taking effect, that's where the real preference lies. And I think that that's important, because it would kind of limit the time frame of it. In this particular circumstance, I'm not sure that it's as big an issue, because Judge Bixler's response is clear. So whether or not he, or why he did not reach out to the parties, doesn't change the ultimate fact that he did not reach out to the parties and the ultimate fact of what it is he said in response to the jury. And I think that leads, unless you have further on issue two, into issue three.
Thank you.
Hearing no questions yet. So the question as presented is, you know, whether an evidentiary hearing was necessary. And my colleague on page 18 of her petition cites to one particular case for that requirement, that being Mann versus State, 118 Nevada 351. And I want to point out that when she cites to that for the argument that an evidentiary hearing is required for these motions, it is in direct opposition to her prior argument in her reply brief to the state's answering brief. Prior to any determination by the Court of Appeals, at page 34, she cites to the exact same case and says that that case applies only to post-conviction habeas petitions and specifically denies its application to either a motion for a new trial or for a motion to reconstruct the record under NRAP 10C.
Mr. Rose, may I ask you a question? I'm sorry, Beth. Justice Stiglitz, on item three. Do you agree, I'm just trying to see where we can agree, do you agree that if a jury sends a note out about a substantive question about an element asking for clarification, that the judge should notify the parties? I just want to start in baby steps here. Do you agree with that?
I believe under the court's case, I would agree with that.
Okay, so obviously he didn't do that. So why isn't that error? Strike that. Is that error, then, that he didn't do that?
I think under these circumstances, it would be error not to at least contact us.
Okay. Now, the fact that it's about force or fear, and the jury specifically rejected the allegation that he had a weapon with him, don't you think it would have been important for some clarification to be given to the jury about that particular element? And if not, why not?
So two responses to that, Justice. First, I did not read the verdict to indicate that they did not find he had a weapon with him. They found he did not have a deadly weapon with him. I would note for the court that the entirety of the description of the knife, which was never found, never photographed, never produced to the jury, was that it was approximately 4 inches long and black in color.
But the jury clearly rejected that when they found him not guilty of the deadly weapon piece, right? I mean, can't we say that they rejected that and get past that piece?
I don't mean to quibble with the judge.
Sure.
A knife is not per se a deadly weapon. They can certainly find that he had a knife, but that we did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the knife that he had constitutes a deadly weapon, particularly given the brevity of the description of it. And again, I don't mean to quibble with the court. I'm just trying to present the court with the state's position on it. Going from that to the justice's question regarding that clarification, we have what my colleague and what trial counsel would have posed as their clarifications. And I think if we look at what those clarifications would have been, that none of those would have changed the outcome. First, my colleague in trial counsel indicated they would have re-requested the petty larceny. Well, A, that's not responsive to the jury's question, but that was also denied previously by the judge, and that was affirmed by the Court of Appeals and not challenged here. Second, they argued they would have asked for the crane instruction. The crane instruction actually was given. That can be found at Volume 2, page 258. So the last two that we actually had are referring them to instructions 6, 11, and 12, or giving the legal Black's Law definition of actual force, fear, and violence. Referring them back to the instructions, I don't see how it could have a different outcome on the case. And indeed, this court has said in Manning versus State, when they were simply told that they can't supplement the evidence, that it was not going to have an impact one way or the other. So then we're left with the legal definitions. These are not questions similar to the ones presented in Gonzalez or Jeffries, with much more complicated questions such as malice aforethought or with conspiracy theory liability. These are everyday common terms, and it might have just been more confusing to give them the legal jargon. Now, I see that I'm almost out of time, so unless there are other questions, I thank the court for its time and ask you to affirm the conviction.
Thank you very much. Ms. Dickinson, you have, 3 minutes and 18 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm a little bit confused. Under issue one, deficiency of the evidence and variance are the same issue. So I don't understand why the prosecutor is arguing that they're different and that we waived it. Clearly, we never waived sufficiency of the evidence. That's why we went to trial. It's the first issue in the opening brief. But we're here on the petition for review. We're not here on everything that was in the opening brief or in the other ones. So I want to go on to the next issue, the issue with regard to the motion for new trial, newly discovered evidence, motion to reconstruct the evidentiary hearing, and for the trial judge. First off, Judge Bixler's response is not clear, as the prosecutor contended, because we never heard it. We only know what Judge Bixler told Judge Smith outside our presence. It was all ex parte. We don't know what happened. We don't know what he said. So we really need to have the trial judge to make the decisions on all of these motions, not Judge Bixler, and clearly this court would need more information also. With regard to the issue of the deadly weapon, I know the prosecutor said, well, the jury may have found that he had a knife, but it wasn't deadly. But that was never an argument made by the prosecutor at trial, so I don't see where that argument even comes from. So I'm not sure how that is relevant.
Ms. Dickinson?
Yes.
Sorry, it's Justice Kadish. If we know... We know that the jury sent out, we now know, obviously, you didn't know at the time, unfortunately, but we know that a note was sent out from the jury, and we know what the response sent back by Judge Bixler was. What is it that an evidentiary hearing would help to clarify other than a fishing expedition? What else are you going to find out? Why would that be important? How would it make a difference?
Well, one of the reasons it's important to see how long they stayed out and kept deliberating after they got the response. Did they come back immediately? Our understanding, and we're not allowed to talk about what we learned from the jurors, but we would find from an evidentiary hearing that they did come back quite quickly after they received that note. Also, it would allow us to know what the marshal did, what he said to them. Did he influence their verdict? Because it all centers
around... Is there some reason to think the marshal acted inappropriately and added something more than what it said in the judge's note?
We did have the declarations from the jurors, and at least one person inferred that something was said. But we are not allowed to discuss that because Judge Smith prohibited us from making that part of the record. So in evidence, even though it is in the record, we're not allowed to address it.
Yes, your time is up. Does Justice Stiglitz have a question?
Yes, may I proceed?
Yes, please.
All right, just briefly, Ms. Dickinson, with respect to the proposed instruction that you would have had Judge Bixler give the jury, how was that substantially different from the way in which the jury was instructed?
Well, what's different is our trial attorney was going to ask for a petty larceny instruction that had been rejected before. He also wanted to give an additional instruction on force as defined under Black's Law Dictionary. She would have had the court bring the jury back in and further instruct them. So they would have been brought into the court and been told what the parties decided. So I think it would have been significantly different. She did make a list of everything that we included in our motion for a new trial of what she would have done differently.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments and briefs. We'll be at recess until 2:30, and thank you for your patience with this virtual process.